So to my right is Don Parrish. Don is a senior director, regulatory relations for the American Farm Bureau's public policy team in Washington, D.C. His expertise is on environmental and conservation policy. He's worked on and works on the Clean Water Act, wetlands, water quality, and the conservation provisions of the Farm Bill. I'm not going to do his whole bio. You can find it in the bio list. To his right is Dick Auld. You might have heard Dick speak in the opening plenary yesterday. And Dick has over 35 years of experience in college-level education, is both a teacher and student advisor. He's won numerous teaching awards. He's trained 45 graduate students during his career. And he has worked a lot with Castor, as you mentioned the other day, and we'll be hearing from him. And to his right, unfortunately, Craig Cox of Environmental Working Group became ill and was not able to make it at the last moment. But we're very lucky to have Chris Clayton, who you all probably know as the MC last night and on some other panels. Chris is, I'll get his bio up in a second. It's at the top, though. Chris is the He's the ag policy editor for the Progressive Farmer that DTN owns. Prior to that, he worked for 7 years for the Omaha World Herald, and he's won numerous awards for agricultural reporting. He was named the National Farmers Union, named Chris as the organization's Agricultural Commuter of the Year in 2009, and has just won a lot of awards and is a great person to talk to about policy and agriculture. So, Don, let's start with you.
Only about 5 minutes, guys, but I want to tell you that Farm Bureau is probably one of the most diverse agricultural organizations we have in this country. If you want to buy it, we'll sell it to you. That's from CSAs to organic. If you want a train carload or a container, we have it. We have members that do UPIC. We also have members that do dude ranches. We have a really, really diverse membership. New Age, I believe, is a little bit of a misnomer. I think agriculture is probably the quintessential adaptive management system that we have in this country. And I'll explain that a little bit more as I go on. But I would say that agriculture, probably more so than anything else in this country, is probably that benefits from the public-private partnership that science and university systems, research and extension, in putting basic and applied research very quickly from the bench into the farmscape, better than any other, I think, business and industry in the country. I also think that our system of adaptive management has allowed us to provide a really, really interesting mixture of deliverables. By that I mean we have affordable food. And by having abundant affordable food, we can also reallocate resources into cleaner water, cleaner air, wildlife habitat, and maybe even energy to some extent. So I do think science, technology has driven that. Now, let me kind of level set with you in terms of what I think agriculture's contribution to the environment has been. And in New Age, if you will, as to where we are today. In 1960, there was 160 million people in this country. Today, there's 340 million. In the world in 1960, they were 3 billion. There's 7 billion today. So no matter how you look at it, human population has doubled its footprint. Now, to surprise you, in 1960, we had 59 million head of pigs in this country. They ate 6 pounds of feed for every pound of pork that they produce. We have 59 million head of pigs in this country today. They eat less than 3 pounds of feed for every pound of pork they produce. Same number of pigs today as we had in 1960. Beef cattle. We had 96 million head of beef cattle in this country in 1960. We have 98 million today. In 1960, we fed them 8 pounds of feed for every pound of beef they produced. We feed them less than 4 today. Dairy animals. We had 19 million head of dairy animals in this country in 1960. We have 9 million today. The 9 million today produce 150% more milk. than they did in 1960. We produced on 360 million acres of tillable land in 1960. We produce on 330 million today. So I don't care how you look at it, the new age of agriculture, whether it's efficiencies, whether it's reallocating resources towards cleaner water, cleaner air, more wildlife habitat, and affordable food, I think our environmental footprint in production agriculture, whether you want your food produced on a CSA, whether you want it produced organically, or whether you don't care, and it's okay to produce it conventionally, our environmental footprint is smaller today than it has been in any time in the last 50 years.
Leave that one with Governor.
Basically, I'm here to learn. I've been in this profession for almost 40 years now, and I enjoy teaching very much. But I'm here to learn what's new and current. This will be the last quarter of a freshman-level class I'm teaching this time, and I've enjoyed it very much going back and renewing some of the statistics that were talked about here as we go through. But basically, I'm looking forward to a lively discussion about where we've been and where we go from here, because as we approach 9 billion people at the midpoint of this century, it's going to be very hard for us to feed them and maintain a quality, a standard of living, which many of them have come to expect.
Can I just ask you to talk a little bit about your work with Castor? Because you started talking about it yesterday. It seems pretty fascinating and what its potential might be.
I work with new crops, strange crops. One of the crops I work with is castor, like the castor oil that your grandmother chased you around with and said, if you'll take a teaspoon of this, you'll feel better. And then you did take a teaspoon and you didn't feel better, at least initially. Castor is a really neat crop. It's an endospermic dicot, and that means that it keeps an endosperm like wheat and corn do, but it's really a dicot. And most dicots, which are like soybeans and beans, by the time they make mature seed, do not have an endosperm. And this allows this special class of dicots to store stuff like racinolenic acid, which normally wouldn't be very healthy for a plant, and store it in this tissue. We're going to talk today on our sustainable crop tour about guar, which makes a gum which is used in fracking and will continue to be used in fracking. It's also used to make bluebell ice cream, smooth and palatable to your taste. And so it's a growing market. And so all of these crops have been focused on one thing: ability to produce with less and less water. In the western U.S., and I made this statement yesterday, and it's something I believe, the western two-thirds of the U.S., okay, get one-third of the precipitation that falls on this country. So when you look at a map of the U.S. west of the Mississippi, it gets very dry. And as we look at water, water is going to be the resource that drives cities, that drives industry, and drives agriculture. And so we're all about the water.
Did I go far enough? You did. Thank you very much. Okay. Yes, you're up.
I can't properly replace Craig Cox. I can't lean quite that far to the left as Craig would be here today, so you're just going to have to stick with maybe somebody who's a little more in the middle. Every year, I feel like I'm dealing with more and more issues when it comes to agricultural policy. Something new is coming up all of the time. This country, the economic growth and the ability for everybody else to do what they do has been framed around the ability to have cheap food all the time. We spend a lot less than anybody else does on food. We have a lot more of it than anybody else does. We've always had it. It's always been a national security issue. Going back to the Civil War, the North was canning food and sending it to its troops. The South, if there was a rabbit moving, they were shooting it just to have something to eat. They were depleted of food in the South. So it's always been that way. The Russians had nukes. We had nukes. We had a big army. They had a big army. They had bread lines. We did not. It's always been our philosophy to have a cheap food policy. Over time, though, because of changes in mindset and our philosophies, everybody's begun to question that a lot more. whether it's because we have weight issues, whether it is simply because of the way food is grown, whether it's because of animal rights or animal protections. More and more questioning of everything that we do involving agricultural policy. I thought about it a little bit yesterday when they were having the first panel on agriculture, and we were talking about how much we need to save and preserve and eat less meat. The night before, we were eating these big, giant slabs of roast beef, and I remember one of my friends passed up on the turkey because he wanted to make sure he got more roast beef. You know, Americans are not going to give up eating beef regardless of any mindset that we have to find a way to shift to foods that have lower greenhouse gas emissions or have fewer inputs. It's just simply not going to happen. Challenges that we simply do have, though, you know, it's constant tug and pull among producers between production and conservation. And the battles that you have over growing issues, whether it's particularly water quality, nutrient runoff and nutrient loads. I'm dealing far more with issues such as the hypoxia zone, such as issues of the Chesapeake Bay than I ever imagined before. I've had to learn a great deal more about some of the science behind that and the demands and water pressures that we're going to have. As American agriculture tries to find a way to put fewer inputs on the ground yet produce more food at the same time, I think it's an amazing challenge ahead. Yet what changes the dynamics of that is also something like fracking. We haven't had a new fertilizer plant in this country built in maybe the last 25 years. Now we've had, in the last 2 months, we have had one proposed in Indiana, Iowa, and North Dakota, as well as one in Canada. Fracking changed that because 85% of the ingredients for anhydrous ammonia is natural gas. So if we're going to be producing a lot more natural gas in the country, we're going to have the ability to produce cheaper fertilizer. That's going to cause even more challenges when it comes to water quality issues if we're going to have cheaper fertilizer when we're talking about the need to put less on the ground. The environmental challenges ahead, it seems like there's just going to be a freight train running down the potential of greater regulation, whether it comes through litigation or a shift in mindset either in Congress or the EPA. Down the line, it's going to be a battle that without greater conservation practices and some change in, quote, sustainability, you're going to see more pressures, particularly as cities get more frustrated maybe with the expenses that they're paying to take those nutrients out of their waterway. And with that, I'll close.
Thanks very much. I'm going to start the conversation off with a couple of questions, and then we'll open up to the audience, and I may steal the show again later on. But the first question I have for all of you is pretty basic. I'm curious, in agriculture, what do you feel is the most underreported story as it relates to the environment in some way? And I'll let anyone take it who wants to take it first, but I hope you all can answer that question.
Oh, I'm looking to look at. I don't like to share my story ideas with anybody. So, the most underreported story. USDA has been rolling out a soil health campaign recently on no-till practices and cover crop. I think just simple, basic agricultural cropping practices is the most undercovered story. The USDA rolled this event out last week to focus on using more no-till, putting in more cover crops, championing the ability to, they call it soil health, putting more organic matter in the soil. I was the only national reporter who went to that meeting, went to that event in Ohio. There were a couple of local reporters, one reporter from a local, from an Ohio agricultural news service. So there was very, very little reporting about at USDA finding ways to promote different agricultural practices that build soil health, protect that shield the sustainability of the land and reduce soil erosion. Soil erosion remains a challenge, particularly in some areas. Very few people write about soil erosion issues or the practices and what farmers are doing to reduce soil erosion.
Thank you. I needed the time to think. I think one of the most underreported stories is what Chris talked about. Fracking has changed our world. I went to a conference at Texas A&M, and we talked to the leaders of Mobil and Chevron, and they talked about peak oil production or peak energy production. And they'd said maybe that was 2004, maybe it was 2007, but it's downhill now. I think if we were to have that conference today, there would be considerable more optimism because of the practice of fracking in the shale formations, directly in the shale formations that hold the gas and hold the petroleum. I've heard an estimate offhand, given at a public meeting, that we're going to have natural gas supplies, prolific natural gas supplies through the rest of the century. And I think our proven reserves of natural gas have gone up 3 to 5 times. It's hard to get people to give you an accurate figure. Most of our nitrogen comes from offshore. And so I'm excited about seeing us have an endogenous, domestic, and I consider Canada domestic, North American supply of nitrogen fertilizer. But here in Texas, we have the Bartlett Shale. We have the Eagle Ford. I was born and raised on the Permian Basin. And we thought when we left that oil field, there would still be more oil downhole than we had taken out in 100 years of drilling and exploitation of it. But with the new fracking experience they have, and it's combined by two technologies, in my opinion, that had came together. Horizontal drilling, you could go down and hit the shale. Then you could turn sideways and bore right through the shale within a few inches or a few feet of where you think you were. And then when you ended up, you pulled the drill back and went down. So now a well, instead of being a vertical shaft, is like a spider web underneath the ground. And then when you frack it, you frack each one of those spider things together. And so we're recovering copious amounts of oil that we thought was going to stay downhole. I have spent two-thirds, maybe 75% of my career working on biodiesel, working on renewable fuels. And I think our need for them as a country, as a dependence, is much less because of this fracking experience that we have than it was even 10 years ago. And so I'm shifting my own program from biofuel to green platform industries where we need linoleums or we need lubricants or we need high-value products that come from renewable carbon. But I think there's been a revolution gone on very quietly over the last 10 years in what our energy reserves are. And that's going to have a profound impact on mechanized agriculture.
I think where you guys make your biggest mistake and you miss your biggest opportunity to report and to kind of exploit the opportunities that are out there is your inability to grasp the complexities of environmental issues. Let's talk about nutrients in particular. They've been mentioned. What if I told you that if you put conservation practices on the land for phosphorus, to control phosphorus, you will accentuate your nitrogen loss problems? And vice versa. What if you do things on the land to stop nitrogen losses, you accentuate phosphorus? What if I told you that if you did things to improve soil health, more no-till, you're going to increase both nitrogen and phosphorus losses? What if I told you that in the Chesapeake Bay, the nitrogen reaching the bay is primarily coming from groundwater? And what if I told you that groundwater was an average of 50 years old? Now, tell me how you're going to put a finger on fixing today's problems with yesterday's issues if the groundwater and the nitrogen that is flowing into the Chesapeake Bay is 50 years old. There's a balance. There's a balance on how we try to achieve the economic, the social, which I don't think our country cares very much about anymore, and the environmental balance that's out there. And I think you guys do the country and farmers and the public a disservice by not being more robust in your talk about the complexities of our environmental problems, because they are tremendously complex.
Just sort of dovetailing on the so in the Farm Bill, in crop insurance obviously is becoming a big issue this year in 2012, and there was an effort by environmentalists to have minimum standards for soil conservation tied to crop insurance. And Don, can you talk about why the your group doesn't think that's a good idea, and explain a little bit what minimum soil conservation measures are? And
The reason we think minimum soil conservation practices are not necessarily a good idea is because the more we know, the more we learn, the more we're able to analyze the data that's out there, the more we may understand that if we do certain types of practices on the land, there may have antagonistic results in other issues out there. Again, back to the phosphorus and the nitrogen issue. If you think you know what the solution is, you're probably wrong, because it's not that easy. And if you have minimum standards, the chances are that things like buffer zones and grass waterways that most people in this room would probably think are a good idea, that I would venture to say in 20 years we may be ripping those things out, because they're not the practice to help us to reduce nutrients. I'm just telling you that you better be careful if you're going to use adaptive management as a way to try to minimize whatever your environmental footprint is. When you lock things into place, people put it on autopilot. They lock it into place and they forget about it, regardless of the environmental outcomes. This country can do whatever they want to. If they want to condition Social Security on drug test or on means test in terms of income levels, they can do that. If they want to condition transfer payments for farm programs or crop insurance, they can do it. But is it a good agronomic idea? It is not.
Chris or Dick, do you want to add to that at all and talk a little bit about soil conservation? And
no, it's not my area.
Yeah.
I'll pass on that.
Once again, as I said, ag is always in this tug and pull between production and conservation. And when prices are high, you're going to see a lot more pull to peel back on the conservation measures. The Conservative Farm Bill, we're going to reduce the maximum CRP acreage by about 5 million acres. Some people, some groups would like to see that peeled back even more. We're not really cutting conservation. We're basically going to be stagnating the dollars, because anytime you're in USDA in government, they talk about cuts, they're cutting the percentage of growth. You know, they're talking about $6 billion cut over the next 10 years. It's actually a cut in the percentage of growth that we would see in conservation practice or conservation spending, not a true hard cut compared to what we're spending today. I see both sides of the issue when it comes to minimum standards for conservation practices. The Farm Bill that the Senate Agriculture Committee has passed has a $50,000 cap on Commodity One farm program payments. If you are a farmer with 10,000 acres in production, you're really not going to care about a $50,000 farm program. You are going to do whatever you can to protect your crop insurance, and you're probably not going to be as concerned about minimum conservation practice from that regard, protecting your commodity program. You're going to use it if you really want to protect your land, protect your soil, protect your sustainability, but it's not going to be a factor when it comes to farm program payments.
Can you just explain, maybe just more clearly, what those measures were? Like, I don't think I completely understand what the soil conservation measures were that were tied to the crop insurance.
It's somewhat a vagary in terms of the minimum standards. But talk about highly erodible land and putting in some basic practices, leaving in some residue. Not heavily tilling right on up to the soil banks, those kind of minimum practices. I said it's a minimum standard. Some farmers would like to see, a much stronger standard. Others, of course, would like to see see that relieved altogether. But you're talking about basic, simple practices to reduce soil erosion, particularly maybe when you don't have the crop growing on the land.
So rather than me keep asking questions, I'm going to open up to the audience. So please, when I pick on you or choose you, say who you are, and SEJ members first, and then we'll go to the next level. Oh, sure.
How many of you did the evening program and visited with the author or The Longest Hard Time or Hardest Hard Time? A grower friend of mine gave me that book, Dale Swinburne. And he gave it to me, and I read it one Christmas, and it was cold and miserable. And I put that book down after I finally finished it and said, this has got to be the most depressing book I ever read in my life. And that shows you what happened when there was huge exploitation on the Great Plains, okay, for a variety of reasons. So what I'm here, and I'm a native of this area, and I had relatives displaced by the Dust Bowl. And the Dust Bowl affected our whole environment, whether you were in the San Joaquin Valley or California or in the streets of Chicago. The Dust Bowl was a national thing. We need to be ensured that there are some conservation practices, options left open to farmers. And here I'm talking about Conservation Reserve Program, okay, where we have such a better environment out here now than we used to have because we have millions of acres. In fact, this part of Texas has over 4 million acres in permanent grass cover from CRP. And so this is not an idle game we play when we say, it's okay, we're going to pay for food stamps out of the conservation funds that we gave. That's not going to be a wise thing to do. What conservation steps we have in the Farm Bill, what incentives there are, financial and otherwise, to encourage and to allow, and some of this is financial, allow farmers to save their own land, is important. And the other thing I'm going to stand up, the biggest problem we have with our agricultural soils worldwide, but particularly here in the U.S., is the loss of carbon. And the biggest problem we have environmentally, arguably, is we have too much carbon in the atmosphere. Do you see? There's a solution there to our problem. I have a dumpster in the back of my house. I have less than a half of 1% of organic nitrogen in my soil, in my yard, or in my farm out here. You're going to visit some of you later this afternoon. And yet I put tree limbs and I put leaves and grass trimmings in there. We as a society, and I don't mean just farmers, have to take what carbon we've been given, what is natural to us, and preserve that. And Conservation Reserve Program in this country has allowed our nitrogen to stabilize. You do the mathematics of figuring out what to go from 0.5% back to 2% organic matter in the soil, and you would have to have a planet full of carbon to do that. But been able to stabilize the carbon loss. And also out here, and I have a colleague in the thing that may want to disagree with me, Sean Wade, we've seen the aquifer that we think is on a 100-year-plus recharge come up in areas where there's large sections of conservation reserve instead of continually going down despite an epic drought. So I want to encourage you as a journalist, it's a real simple answer to balance a budget, to pay for food stamps out of what few conservation funds are left in the Farm Bill. That's going to be a very expensive Band-Aid when it has to be remade.
Okay, let's start a question. Sure.
I really believe, again, I appreciate what Dick said. I think more than anything else in agriculture, maybe rather than minimizing conservation, we do need to think more in systems and how they fit together. Again, I was on a farm in Argentina this last year where he hasn't tilled his soil in 10 years. No-till. And he basically says over that 10-year period of time, the amount of carbon I've added back to the soil, the amount of residue that I have on top of my soil, has added an additional 5 inches of rainfall on an annual basis to my production. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of research and understanding that farmers need to understand. Now, farmers have to, when they see that, when they hear that, when they understand it, when we have it in kind of that community of learning, those outreach and field days that researchers do for farmers, They'll be pretty quickly to adopt it. And we need to think about systems, because I promise you, most of the conservation gains that we're going to make in this country for cleaner water, cleaner air, those types of things, they're going to happen on our tillable acres, but they're also going to happen off to the side of the field, too, in things like two-stage ditches and treatment wetlands and buffers and conservation areas where we pick where to spend our money and how we spend it. So it is important.
So just don't forget the panel we're getting sort of in the, you know, real the farmland, but the panel is about everything and all questions are fair game, GMOs, sustainability, labeling, biofuels. So Jim, why don't you start and identify?
Again, I think it, as I said in my opening statement, Jim, I think farmers are going to be, adaptive very quickly. They will adapt in the kind of tillage practices they use or the lack thereof. I think we'll see less tillage. And when you till less, the soils will hold more moisture. And I think farmers will see the benefit of that pretty quickly. And I think the the issue with tillage in this country is temperature. We want to warm the soils up so that seeds germinate quicker, so that they get the benefit of a growing season and the heat units that the plants need to produce what they produce. I think science and helping those seeds get off to a better growing start when the soils are colder, when there's more carbon in the soil and the soils are colder, the better off we're going to be. And I just see both. I think I see plant breeding coming to bear. I think I see farmers' tillage practices coming to bear. And I see being very adaptive in terms of what happens in terms of their adaptation to climate changes.
Go ahead, Chris, and then Doug.
It's going to come down to how farmers manage hydrology. You have in the certainly it's different here in Texas where we have such a dry climate, but when you get up to the north, we have we've seen obviously a pattern of these really intense rainfalls coming in short times, and the ability of the soil to absorb that water is going to be tremendous, not just simply for farmers adapting, but also flood control for the cities downstream of where these rain events occur. The ability, the capacity to hold moisture into the soil is going to be more critical in the future, not just simply because of the intense rain events, but managing for those droughts and dry times. That's part of the reason USDA is doing this soil health campaign is finding ways to get that soil to hold more moisture in it. But we've seen these adaptations simply by farmers making changes themselves. And you've seen in some areas both more tiling going in, which is tiling basically are underground tubes that let the get the water running off the land, while at the same time more irrigation going in. Because the rainfall patterns have changed, the farmers are having trouble getting into the fields when they want to in the spring, because the rains are coming earlier, so they want that rainwater to come off. But at the same time, when the summer, when they need moisture, they're seeing it at less time, so they're putting in irrigation. You have these mixes of these patterns going on, but you also see the changes that you see in cropping. As I mentioned, I was really surprised to see that feedlot around here planting triticale. That was not something, and that's not a cover crop is what I normally see triticale planted for. They're using it as a forage, and they're using it because the guy said it takes less water, and they can grow it the winter time when they're not competing with the corn farmers for that moisture.
I'd like to make a comment on that, too. Our local farm magazine published a really fine article about 2 weeks ago, and it says as part of global warming, our climate is going to be more erratic. And as part of global warming, we're going to have more violent events, just exactly what was talked about. I'm passing around to the audience a graph that shows what portion of the disposable income Americans spend on their food, and it's under 10%. There's no country in this world that spends that little on their food and has such a good food supply. Back in 1930, the average American, even though we were an agrarian society back then, spent something like 24% of their disposable income on food. This year, we've had a drought. And whether that drought in the Mid, we have a drought every year, so we're kind of used to it. But when the Midwest has a drought, it's national news. And we had a drought in the Midwest, and now they're saying, should we make our biofuel allotments, our FS2 allotments for corn ethanol, or should we allow the corn to go back into the feed chain? And so there's hard questions being asked. I can tell you what, as we go to global change, this ability to depend on a total food supply, a cheap, readily available food supply, even in the U.S., is going to be questionable. I'm not suggesting Armageddon. I'm just going to say it's always been duck soup. We had this year's crop in storage before we planted it. And you're going to see that it starts to affect people, and when it affects their pocketbook, okay, that's what it's going to be done. The graph I'm passing around shows the trend to 2010. So I'm sitting here waiting for 2014 when the 2012 figures come out to see if it kicks back and to see if it kicks back politically, because cheap food has been our 11th right of our Bill of Rights, you know. And I'm anxious to see where that goes. So climate change is liable to affect every American at the base level.
A lot of people. Jill, why don't you go? Okay. And well, identify yourself.
Certainly.
And
I'm Jill Richardson. I'm a freelancer. I cover agriculture. So the more organic matter you have in your soil, fertilizer, to other forms of fertility.
My initial thought is I'm not sure that I am familiar with the research that you point out that commercial or inorganic fertilizer reduces soil carbon. I think it has to do with how we manage residue on top of the soil. And the thing that we have to do is to help farmers understand how to manage that residue. In some cases, there's so much residue that they have a hard time establishing subsequent crops. So they have to figure out a way to kind of till a little and not completely reduce the release the carbon that the in the soil that by doing that tillage. I think our greatest challenge is not so much our greatest challenge right now, and again I, back to your one of your underreported things, we're driving tractors right now with satellites, and we're also farming with tools that allow us to be very precise, location specific. If a certain area of our field is more productive than another, we can treat it as if it's more productive. And in an area that's less productive, we can treat it as if it's less productive. We can tailor what we utilize. But all in all, we are going to have to be, I think, in the future, figure out a way to bring systems to bear. And that systems is kind of holistic. I don't deny that. I think that's we've lost that in agriculture somewhat, and I think we can bring it back, but it's not going to be a shift all over here or all over here. It's going to be how we bring it all together to make sure that we maintain productivity and efficiencies.
Anyone want to add to that, Chris or Dick?
No, I thought that was a very good summary.
Okay, the gentleman in the...
Greg Miller, King Media. So we... on the same tack, you know, that some of the anecdotes we've heard here are very interesting about weight and techniques for moisture retention. But
you're the researcher.
Yeah. Let me start this with an apology, okay? I was on Christy George's panel yesterday, and she asked me, what soil nutrients are we going to run out of? And we're not going to run out of nitrogen, but we may run out of phosphorus. And where they get phosphorus, oftentimes those countries are not very favorable to the U.S., and their governments are not always open for trade. And so my society, the American Society of Agronomy, which I'm a 40-year-plus member of, publishes all this great research about what's going to happen, and I told Christy, I'll have that. Let me go sit down in front of my computer. And I was blocked time after time. If you would like a reprint of this article, please submit $15 on a credit card. Our professional, my science, has done a very poor job of delivering scientific information. I have colleagues that could sit here and preach to you for the next 3 hours about phosphorus and make you sick, okay? But you'd be highly informed when you got done. Our scientific community, whether it's Texas Tech or whether it's USDARS or University of Nebraska, we have done a poor job as scientists at commuting to the lay people. And I'm going to ask you, and I know this isn't your question at all, next time you ought to invite the presidents of a couple of these professional societies and says, please, please, get this in a one-paragraph bullet format so we can read it and report it. Okay, that would help.
And that's actually where I'm heading when I leave here. I'm going to Cincinnati to the acronyms kill me, but the Soil Society of America, the American Agronomy Society, and one other
Crop Science Society.
You lose them all. Three different groups meet every year, and that's where I learn a lot about what's going on with soil science and what these guys are saying, and then trying to find the guy who not only is a scientist but also speaks English, and having him explain. And so, but very few journalists at all go to these meetings, and talk about absorbing. You can just learn so much. In fact, the panels and there's so much stuff goes on at these meetings. You have to clone yourself to try to absorb it all that's talked about. The problem you have with wholesale changes, though, in agriculture is farmers farm for the market that's out there. You know. If corn is at $7, farmers, if they have the ability to grow corn, they're going to plant corn that next year. If soybeans are at $13, $14, if you have a lot of infrastructure in cotton, you just bought a new cotton combine, and I'm not sure what the cost is, but you can't use that combine for cotton for anything else. You got to grow cotton. Or you got a machine that sits there fallow for a year that you wasted money on for no reason. So it's a mix of all of those economics of either A, the market's telling me to grow corn, or B, I have so much investment in this certain crop, I have to grow this crop until I can't grow it anymore. Yeah.
Before you do, Dick, I would say that one of the things you need to understand, I think, is that cotton is a desert crop. And it probably is one of the least water-demanding crops we have in this country. So I think the last place we'll see it disappear is out here. We've already seen it dramatically change in the Mississippi Delta, what we call the Mid-South, Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and Georgia. Alabama, Georgia, a lot more droughty soils. You're seeing some feed grain-type productions there. But clearly throughout the Mid-South, where there are very great, really, really good soils, a lot more corn production, a lot more soybean production. And you've seen Mississippi go from 1 million acres of cotton to 200,000 acres of cotton in the last decade. And you're seeing, you know, you are seeing shifts very quickly as to what our markets demand. And I think you will continue to see that. But clearly, Texas is probably one of the last places we'll see cotton disappear.
Again, I might defer to Sean for the actual details. But in this area is not very huge. It's about 150 miles of Lubbock. We seed about 4 million acres of cotton every year. And it varies year to year. But most years, only half of that is irrigated. And some years, and like 2011, we didn't harvest a lot of cotton off our dry land acres. And we're going to have some acres this year that are not harvested too. But my graduate student who defended her master's degree, Braley, and her husband farmed 2,000 acres. The two of them, she's the farm bookkeeper and he's the tractor driver, at one hard of hand farmed 2,000 acres, and their dry land this year made 0.9 bales, which is phenomenal. And we had a 30-year drought this year. So when I line up my desert crops, number one on value and adaptability is cotton. But we need some additional genetics on cotton to back that up. Today at the USDA lab, you're going to meet...
Could you repeat that? What was their yield?
0.9 bales.
In other words, not even a bale.
Not a bale. A bale is about 500 pounds. It's 500 pounds with a wrapping, isn't it, Sean? And so they got about 450 pounds or maybe 430 pounds of cotton per acre. And there have times when we had poor genetics in this area, we got a bale of cotton off irrigated ground. We were going to the bank, okay? But we've had a genetic revolution over the last 10 years, and now we have higher yield expectations, part of the genetics and part of the management. But our biotech companies, Bayer, Monsanto, and our USDA ARS and some of my colleagues at Tech are making wonderful strides on adding improved drought and heat tolerance into cotton. And so one of these days, we're going to be able to have a bale of cotton dry land every year except 2011. And I'm sorry, we couldn't even grow tumbleweeds in 2011.
I saw some tumbleweeds on some land out here. Yeah.
We do a good job of that, but that year it was tough.
Okay. Who's one way?
Thanks. Rich Bonstein, Environmental.
When I made the comment that our soils are losing carbon, that's true. I mean, and that's globally. And this was a short grass prairie. And me and my friends in range argue about when we get done whether the high plains will be a short grass prairie. But if the high plains from here to Amarillo and north turn back into a prairie, we will supply jobs for about 50 cowboys. And it'll make about $500,000. If we allow our agriculture industry to collapse, not only that, but the world's supply of exportable cotton will disappear with that, a very large significant of it. So the chances of stopping doing what we're doing economically and socially and infrastructure cost, when you grow cotton, you've got to have a harvest. And out here we use a stripper, and they're $250,000. And then every 10 miles you have to have a cotton gin. And they can be $100 million. The new ones are. And you cannot bring that infrastructure in and take it out, and so you're locked in. What you suggest about carbon is a good thing. I mean, it's a very idealistic thing. We've got too much CO2 in the air. Let's fix some of it and put it in the soil. And believe me, my colleagues at the ASA and CSSA and SSA are conducting some wonderful work on that. And so we're trying to put the tools together to take what's a problem here and a problem here and make it a solution for both. Am I answering your question at all?
Yeah, but also just the second part. Is there a constituency among the farmers?
Good. Go ahead.
I've been drinking soil health Kool-Aid a lot lately. And there are some groups, particularly I would say in Kansas, there's No-Till on the Plains. And I've been to some of their meetings, been on some of their tours. They focus very heavily on no-till ever and sequestering the carbon in the soil, putting planting cover crops to do that. But as far as mitigation, as you had suggested, you're just not going to have a good ecosystem market unless you have a regulatory reason to have one. You know, this is why the Chicago Climate Exchange failed. If you don't have a real drive from the buyer side, you're just not going to have a reason to have it. There were several million acres in the Chicago Climate Exchange on land. It all collapsed after the 2009 legislation failed. Right now, the big issue in that regard is whether the California Air Resources Board is going to allow agricultural offsets. And will they also, when they do that, are they going to allow it, you know, can a farmer in Iowa get an agricultural offset in the CARB program for a California company, you know? But those decisions have not been made as of yet. A lot of people are watching that to see, you know, what the California Air Resources Board direction is going to be.
Yeah, go ahead.
Lisa Palmer, I'm a freelancer from Maryland. Hi, good area.
You fly into Lubbock, and we've had a wet year.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yes, the question is that increased soil microbial activity may offset the ability to sequester more carbon into the soil. When you fly into this area from the airport, lots of times when it's rained, it looks like there's a silver dollar on each section. I pick people up at the airport, and they say, what are all those circles? And I say, oh, those are circles. And that's not a very definitive answer because that's circle pivot irrigation. And they say, no, the shiny circles. What are the shiny circles? And I tell them, they're playa lakes. Playa Spanish means beach. So sometimes they're a beach and sometimes they're a lake. And it tells you, and they go clear up to Nebraska here on the High Plains. For years, and each section got one playa lake. Some of them were pretty small, and some of them took the whole section. And they're laid out, and they're a geologic artifact that we don't understand. We can't really farm. We can't really manage. One of my colleagues wrote a competitive grant and got $500,000 and put together a team to study those playa lakes. It turns out those playa lakes are going to be a critical key component to understanding carbon sequestration up here on the High Plains. The water runs there. Organic matter, unfortunately, floats. Okay? It floats into the Playa Lake, and it's got a heavy clay soil, so it holds that soil there for months at a time after a rain event. And she's just now starting to investigate what happened, what was the rate of carbon degradation, what depth of the soil, what temperatures did it occur at, did it occur in the winter as well as the summer? And so what you want to know, we don't know. And if we did, we'd still write it up so you couldn't read it anyway.
I'm going to take moderator's privilege here and sort of shift the conversation a little bit. But so in California right now, there's a Proposition 37 is hoping to label GMO food. And I'm curious. I hear from the farm industry a great pride in GMO work, and yet there's a resistance to labeling GMO food in the U.S. And Don, I'll let you take that first, obviously, and then the others.
I'm the water quality guy. I'm not the GMO. I'm not the sustainability guy in the Farm Bureau. But here's what I'm concerned about with issues like Proposition 37. I believe it's framed as a consumer right to know. But I'm not sure consumers really are demanding to know, number one. But number two, I think it's more meant to undermine our regulatory system and create fear of science than it is to actually give people information that they can base real-life decisions on. That's what I'm concerned about, whether it's USDA APHIS, whether it's FDA, whether it's the Food and Drug Administration. It doesn't matter. These types of processes are meant to sensitize people to something that may or may not be a fear. And if there are true fears, then the consumers have a right to know. But if we're just doing this to try to undermine people's confidence in our food supply and our ability to produce an abundant food supply, then are we doing our society a favor?
The other day from a farmer about this issue, and he had emailed me a story from some group that was supportive of Prop 37 and questioning the funding from Monsanto and some of the food companies and others about the labeling. He had an interesting argument in that by having the campaign to resist it, it creates even more perception in people's minds that there's something wrong and something being hidden when there isn't nothing there. When the agricultural industry could take the position and take the opportunity to explain to people all of the benefits, and maybe by what's happening in California and the way it's going down, you are creating a fear that doesn't need to be there at all. And by opposing it the way it's being opposed, I mean, frankly, I don't really care if it's labeled or not. But I certainly understand the benefits that come from biotechnology and what's occurred just in terms of yield production in some of our various crops. So I'm concerned. I'm curious to see how all this plays out, because I think that the resistance that has been there so much, maybe from the industry, perhaps does more damage than good by, again, once again, you know, creating a, butting heads over something. People who have no interest or, desire to understand are going to go, well, what's the problem here? Why do they resist? And so I am concerned from that point of view.
I'm going to give a real quick
response.
No, please. Armin was born and raised in Hobbs, New Mexico, and a short distance away is Roswell. You know where the alien spaceship? And that would have died a healthy death, except the government sealed everybody's lips and swore they'd persecute and everything, and so a myth arose around.
That's not true. The truth is out there.
But I agree. Proposition in California was not written as a balanced act. It was written for certain political activities. If you want to label something, you need to get both sides together at the same table and sit down and write a workable, worthwhile document. We saw this with the trans fatty acids. I've worked on lipids my whole life, and when trans fatty acids come out, we're going to go broke if we have to label trans fatty acids. And then everybody, I'm going to get sick and die. It took a concerted effort to get both components at the table and write the worthwhile, enforceable document. And so what I worry about California is not that we're going to label GMOs. I think it's going to be an affirmation. It's going to shock you how many products GMOs are on. And that's probably a healthy thing, okay? But what I'm worried about is it wasn't a drafted document that industry participated in drafting. So that's going to ask for certain things that are impractical. But it's going to make a great debate topic for the last third of my class.
Why don't you go ahead and then we'll come
over. I'm Ashley Irvin.
I think if they want to know, they can buy it. I think. No. I'm thinking if, you know, it's kind of back to the point of, you know, if there's a demand for that level of information, you know, our system is set up to supply it, you know, and again, it's a supply and demand issue. If consumers want that, they can, you know, our system is set up that if they're willing to pay
more for every product,
or however it's labeled or whatever, yes, there is a way to segment our food supply. And right now, I don't see the consumer being willing, you know, across the board to buy that. To pay for that. You know, do they have the right to know? You know, they have a right to know that our food safety, our drug safety, all of the things that go into our system is working properly. And, you know, I guess ultimately, if they want to know down to the precise whatever's in it, yes. You know, maybe they do. But I think, as Dick said and as I tried to say, I think what this is more about, what I think Prop 37 is about, is undermining confidence in our food safety and our FDA system. I think it's less about the demands of consumers, you know, across the board really wanting to know.
Let me give a very quick example, okay? I like catfish. I was at Bass Pro Shop, and I bought a T-shirt that says, "I catch cats and kill them." And it wasn't furry cats. It was catfish. I love catfish. I run trot lines when I'm out fishing, and they're delicious. Some of my catfish now glow in the dark since the plutonium levels got so high. And so I was distressed when I read an article from one of you guys here how much of the U.S. catfish crop comes from Vietnam. I've been to the Mekong Delta. I waded across it time after time, and I'm not anxious to eat catfish out of it, okay? So we had this country of origin labeling, okay? I wanted that information. I'm sure the USDA has checked that, double-checked it, and triple-checked it, but I still would like to have the option to choose to do that or not to do that. That said, you better believe that stuff from Vietnam that we label came from Vietnam, from the U.S. is going to be labeled in that country too. It has to be done fairly and equitably across there. But I agree with you. It's a consumer's right to know, okay, as long as it's practical to do it.
So I am sworn to stop this at noon, and it's about 10. So I'm going to go to you in the back and identify yourself, and then Jill, and then a few other people.
Just curious on the fracking. You said it's going to revolutionize mechanized agriculture. How is that going to
The reason I got into biofuels research was we do not have the labor force that Brazil has or India has or China has. And so our agriculture is based on a family farm of a husband and a wife, generally, and maybe one hard hand, and they have to farm 2,000 acres. To make our agricultural system as we know it today exist, we have to do that with machines. We have to have large tractors. We have to have strippers. We have to have pickers. We have to have combines to do that. And so my thoughts in renewable fuels was always that the fuels never left the farm gate, that they were grown on the farm. We used to grow forages. We had mules at the farm gate. So the fuels would be produced in the country on the farm where they were going to be consumed. I don't believe we have sustainable agricultural resources to put 10 or more percent ethanol in everybody's car to fuel the urban commute each day. I mean, that's just mind-boggling. We have to have a small ocean of ethanol to do that. And so I was always looking at renewable fuels, farm-produced, farm-used, okay? But I'm also looking at a population increase of 2 billion people in the next 30, and we're going to have to take those acreages that we're going to grow biodiesel, because diesel is the farm fuel we use, and now we can put it back into crop production using cheaper and sustainable, at least partially sustainable, petroleum-based fuels.
Great.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Real quick, because this is where I kind of switch from being a journalist somewhat. I love biofuels. I live in Iowa. Did you guys have a recession? We really didn't. Our unemployment rate really never got above 6.5%. Nebraska never really got above 4.5%. The biofuel industry in the Midwest sustained those areas of the rural Midwest that really had seen recessions and not seen economic growth in a very long time. I think it's a great story that we have gone from 2 billion gallons 10 years ago to 12, 13 billion gallons of ethanol now. I also live in a state that has 18% wind energy. I think rural America has great potential when it comes to wind, solar, biomass, and biofuels. Everybody fixates on the fact that ethanol is not as efficient as gasoline or whatever. I would love to see what the lobby groups had been like if we went when we converted from the horse to the Model T. Because there would have been so much outrage from the blacksmith industry, the veterinarian industry, the stable industry. We have sustainable resources in horses. Why would you possibly go to that inefficient vehicle called the Model T? Renewable biofuels need to be given a better chance. Somebody out there is going to figure out how to make algae work, and somebody out there is going to do it. But if our country walks away from it, we're going to go right back to the cycle we were when I was a child in the 70s, and I remember everybody freaking out about gasoline back then, and eventually we moved on. But, you know, what we've seen in with biofuels has been quite an amazing story, and I'd like to see it continue. And like I said, I think it's been the best economic development tool we've seen in rural America in a very long time.
Right. I was going to say, one more question, but you have to be downstairs at noon, and you have to be seated to get lunch. So you have to go here and go downstairs and sit down, and then you will get lunch. But, Joe, why don't you go ahead, because you had your hand up. Yeah, no, please.
I wish I could answer that question. I do think there is a proper balance, and, you know, back to this lady's, I think we can deliver and function and do it all, but we don't need to do it in such a way that we undermine the credibility of our system. And I think that's the point Dick made, and I'll stand on that point too.
Thanks a lot for coming.
There's ways we can light it.
Yeah, thanks.
I agree.
Thank you. Sorry I got everyone out of here before.